to provide some input, so rather than have them wait around, we're going to do that now. And then our folks for the item number 9 are here earlier, so then we're going to go right into that. So at this point, I'd like to call up Amarouk Weiss, excuse me, and Zurai Wazin. I probably just didn't do justice to your family names. And there's 3 minutes. I don't know if you heard earlier, but you get 3 minutes, and then the buzzer will go off, and you will not get ejected from your seat. No. I disabled that, but that's so. Amaru, it's up to you. Amaru,
okay, thank you. We both have unusual names, so thank you.
For Smith, it's, you know, everything's unusual.
Chair Smith, members of the commission, Director Unsworth. My name is Amarouk Weiss. I'm the West Coast Wolf Organizer for the Center for Biological Diversity. I am a biologist and a former attorney, so you get a twofer with me. And I've been working in wolf policy, wolf recovery policy, for 20 years. I was a member of the stakeholder groups in Oregon and California that helped advise the state wildlife agencies there in developing their state wolf plans. And my comments today are delivered on behalf of the 30,000-plus Washington residents who are members and supporters of my organization. And I know you heard earlier today, because I was here this morning, from a member of the public who believes that the path that the agency and the WAG are on with regard to wolves right now is the best path forward. And while we greatly respect and know many of the people that are involved in these efforts, and we respect the efforts that they've made, our perspective is quite different. I've provided your staff with a much more thorough 7-page comment letter, so I'm going to try to keep my testimony condensed, which I'm afraid means I'm probably going to talk pretty fast. We believe that the protocols and the policies that have been implemented are seriously flawed. And as a result, Washington's wolves have suffered very unjustified and harsh consequences. And as a result, the public is justifiably outraged. It happened in 2012 with the Wedge Pack. It happened in 2014 with the Huckleberry Pack. And it's happened again this summer with the Profanity Peak Pack. So once again, the state did not have in place a protocol that required ample, appropriately employed, timely employed, proactive conflict deterrence measures that were suitable for the terrain and the circumstances. Once again, the state has spent tens of thousands of taxpayer dollars to kill the public's wolves to benefit private for-profit ranchers on public lands. And the conflicts between the Profanity Peak Pack and the cattle that were on the Colville National Forest were actually quite predictable. And in fact, they were predicted in February of this year by rancher Len McIrvin in an interview he gave in an article in Progressive Cattlemen. The kill operation took place under this lethal control protocol that was agreed to this spring by the WAG, but WDFW has not appointed any scientists or economists to be on the WAG, even though the WAG is tasked with advising the agency on wolf issues, which must be informed by the best available science and by cost-benefit analyses. Arriving at the protocol involved no discussion whatsoever, I was there, on the scientific literature on the effectiveness of lethal versus non-lethal control, on the cost efficiency of lethal versus non-lethal control, on the effects of lethal control on wolf ecology, pack structure, reproduction. None of the literature that links killing of wolves with reduced social tolerance for wolves was discussed, and there wasn't any consideration for a differing aspect of a higher threshold for if wolves could be killed on public versus private lands. The protocol also actually disregarded science that is cited to in the wolf plan and objectives that are cited to in the wolf plan. And all of these are absolutely essential in order to formulate credible wolf conservation decisions. The failure to address the science on these key issues has resulted in the near elimination of an entire wolf pack and a protocol which lacks credibility or support from the public. The state holds wildlife as a public trust for everyone. And unfortunately, the representatives on the WAG don't speak for all the members of the public. And since the public didn't have adequate opportunity to weigh in, they feel justifiably outraged. After the Wedge Pack fiasco in 2012, to prevent that scenario from happening ever again, my organization and two allies filed an administrative petition with this commission requesting that you engage in rulemaking to enact regulations to provide enforceability, transparency, and accountability, and have a process that legally mandated public involvement. Unfortunately, our petition was denied, and unfortunately, we then had the next fiasco. I'll just finish up in 30 seconds, please. From this experience, it's clear to us and the public that the WAG alone and WDFW is not the appropriate body for deciding whether wolves will die in response to conflicts with livestock. Instead, these issues, which have significant legal and conservation ramifications for the species, these should really be addressed through a public rulemaking process by this commission in which proposed protocols for lethal control could undergo robust scientific scrutiny and public involvement. We greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. We always do. I know I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer any questions if you have some. And your staff will be providing you later with the 7-page letter.
Great. Thank you, Amaruk. Questions from commission? No? Thank you. Very informative. Appreciate that. And Sarai?
Right, that's correct. Hi. So I'm a student, kind of an innocent bystander in the situation, but kind of going off of what Amaruk has been talking about, I've been kind of working with people and going up to Ferry County to kind of take a look and research the situation myself and get a feel for the situation. I definitely think that there is a solution to the conflict. It's very, very complicated as it is in both the rancher's perspective and the wolf's, but I composed a short video here that kind of elaborates on the environment and the incident between the wolves and the ranchers and possibly a solution. Might not have sound, sorry. Oh. Okay, thank you.
She's a wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that. Sorry, it's a little bit of a rough draft. But there's kind of an inside look of the environment and what we're looking at. If there's any questions or comments, love to be able to answer some for you.
Thank you, Zariah. Let me first say that keep your interest and keep following this. We need young people like yourself to solve these problems now and into the future. So you've done an outstanding job.
Thank you.
And let your heart and your mind work together as you go forward on this. So
thank you.
Any other comments from the
commission? Yeah, it raises a question. So I know some of the wolves were killed were in that fire. That was part of the problem, I guess, with tracking them. Were the cattle that were depredated in the burned area as well? I mean, what?
Yeah.
Do you know that? I'm actually looking at staff. So.
Uh-huh.
Do we know?
We don't know for sure sitting here.
Okay.
We can get that information.
Because it is a little puzzling what cattle are doing grazing in a large burn.
Yeah, so that was footage that I've collected. I have plenty more. But that's some of the footage I've collected during my expedition traveling through the forest there. So yeah, those are cattle that were found in the burnt forest. I think that's what you call it. Is that kind of what you're wondering? Yeah.
Well, I was wondering exactly where the depredations that we looked at located.
Yeah, so about like a mile radius within that picture that was taken that had the cattle in them in the video was where one of the first depredations were taking place. So still in the burned area, which is, kind of weird.
Any other comments from commissioners? Thank you both. Appreciate it. Larry Buckland, and you've been before us before, so you know the rules.
Thank you.
3 minutes. Hopefully everybody's received the distribution of my comments back to the department on rule changes. I'm here to talk about rule changes. I apologize for not being here tomorrow to do that, but as will become clear, there's a conflict with me and what I'm speaking to on my submittals versus an organizational submittal tomorrow and getting it all in 3 minutes. So that said, I have submitted 5 rule change proposals this year, one of which was a technical change, and that was accepted and is incorporated in the technical change portion. I submitted 4 others that were all rejected, and I have sent an email to you all, but I decided that I would come down today and stand behind my submittals, if you will. So there should be a copy there for you, and hopefully you'll have a chance to look at it before tomorrow's discussion with the staff on them. And I'll run through them very quickly. Am I coming across?
Yes.
My ears are... The first one that I submitted had to do with being able to reduce crab catch from unregistered boats at the beach. And when I say unregistered boats, that's anything under 16 feet without a motor on salt water. All right. So essentially we're talking about beach launch skiffs or kayaks. My contention is we have areas that we have severe weather blow up between tides and wind, and we can get out in my 9-foot skiff when I shouldn't be out there pulling gear. And I shouldn't be by law required to try to row, try and fight the tide while I'm measuring crab, getting them out of the pots, getting them measured, sex them, and then record them. But the current regulations require that. So from a safety standpoint, better handling for myself and the crab, more accurate measuring and recording, and avoiding abandoned gear, I think that's something that should be considered. Second one was shiner perch, and I submitted a proposal to allow the use of forage fish gear to harvest up to 15 shiner perch which are primarily used as bait. And somewhere, hopefully, I brought a sample of shiner perch gear or forage fish gear. Is that before you? Didn't get from the desk to here. Okay. They're generally very small fish with small mouths. We're using a number 16 hook with a little piece of feather or fish skin on it. And it's barbed. In order for that, but they have normally 9 hooks on them, which makes them illegal to use for shiner perch. Forage fish, yes. Well, that was a quick 3 minutes. Anyhow, two more that are crab-related. One is the idea of allowing recreational crabbers to start with the first tribal pot, and that's just an equity thing, being able to crab on the most, the maximum harvestable biomass. And it's kind of a policy thing, as is the second, which is in areas 2 east and 2 west, particularly, and also the San Juans and the Straits, to allow the winter season to start right after the summer season, because the last 3 or 4 years of harvest data has shown that there's more than adequate state share left to be able to have that good weather crabbing in September. So that's all I've got. I will probably see you all tomorrow with a different hat on. So are there any questions before I hit the road north?
I think you raised interesting points.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, Larry. And we'll look forward to seeing what hat. Now you have my curiosity piqued for tomorrow.
I will be here tomorrow.
Thank you.